Robinson versus the Commonwealth.
Good morning. I'd like to reserve 5 minutes, if possible.
5 minutes, yes, ma'am.
Could I ask you to speak up a little bit? I think
yes,
we have trouble hearing you.
May it please the court, my name is Rachel Robinson. I'm an assistant public defender in the Loudoun County office, and I represent Mr. Donald Robinson.
No relation, I assume.
No relation. This case is where we're asking the court to remand for resentencing based on erroneously introduced evidence. The trial court admitted evidence in a prior conviction that included information about a grand larceny charge of which Mr. Robinson was not convicted.
How do you handle the amendment of the code, code section 19295.1, that changed prior convictions to prior criminal history?
Yes, sir. I think that it still applies. I think that the criminal history is still governed. I'll say it this way. I think first, the criminal history is still referencing criminal convictions.
But wouldn't that require us to find that the General Assembly just did a useless act?
No, because as we've pointed out in the reply brief, the General Assembly amended that to include an additional item that should be submitted to the jury, the sentence that was imposed. And I think that is what the General Assembly was getting at, is that from now on, this history includes not just the name of the conviction, but also the sentence that was imposed.
So they used the term criminal history, but really meant just sentence.
Sentence and conviction, yes, sir.
Well, let me ask you about prejudice. First of all, you know, we bifurcate these situations now, so that there's no risk that a jury is going to convict someone, find them guilty, as opposed to deal with a sentence issue based upon information that goes beyond what they were convicted of previously, but what they were actually originally charged with previously. So that's one issue. It seems to me there's less risk of prejudice in a bifurcated situation where you're dealing with a sentence. And then I noticed from the record that and I don't know if you were trial counsel or not, but
I was one of the trial counsel.
Okay.
Yes.
Well, I know. Well, whether it was you or your colleague, but you requested to the jury, suggested to the jury that they sentence something up to 12 months in jail, which is exactly what your client got from the jury in terms of incarceration. So I question, and of course, the Commonwealth attorney asked for double that. And so I question whether your client was in any way prejudiced by this fact, when the jury obviously agreed more with you in terms of what the ultimate sentence should be than they did with your opponent at the trial level, the Commonwealth attorney. So talk to me about, or talk to us about how your client is prejudiced by this, the fact. I mean, the jury is aware that they were originally charged with grand larceny, but they're also aware that that's not what he was convicted of. He was convicted of petty larceny. So there's that. You know, the jury has a complete knowledge of that particular offense, and that he wasn't convicted of what he was originally charged with. And then on top of that, they honor your request that he be sentenced to within the range that you suggest, or your team suggests, I should say.
I would disagree with Your Honor about him being sentenced to what we've suggested. We suggested
suggested 0 to 12, or somebody
However,
suggested
the jury
0 to 12.
Sentenced him not only to the 12 months active time, or 12 months of jail, but also a $2,500 fine, the maximum fine possible. The jury had four options at sentencing. They could give him any fine up to $2,500, which is its own range. They could give him any jail sentence up to 12 months, which is its own range. And third, they could give him any jail sentence up to 12 months plus any fine up to $2,500. And essentially, the jury maxed him out on everything they could but prison time. The only of the four options, the 1 year to 10 years imprisonment, is the one step they didn't take. And so they went beyond what certainly defense counsel had asked, which is certainly prejudicial to Mr. Robinson, who, by my appointment, and is in the record, has been found indigent. They required him to serve 12 months of jail and to then, after 12 months of unemployment, pay a $2,500 fine, which I would argue is prejudicial and is certainly beyond what we may have to concede was suggested to them. It was not only the maximum possible range we had even proposed was reasonable for active time.
Well, of course, the jury could have ignored both of your recommendations, and because one of the offenses is, I think, carries up to 10 years, doesn't it?
It does. This offense was punishable by up to 10 years in prison.
Yeah, so, I mean, they could have sentenced him to 10 years in prison and didn't.
Correct. I would argue to the court, though, that where that is the fourth rung available to them, I can point the court to page 78 of the appendix is the jury instruction on this, and it lays out its 4 points, 1, 2, 3, 4, and it shows them their options. And so they only said no thank you to the imprisonment, but then they maxed him out on everything else. And where in this case we don't know, and it's pure speculation on our part to determine how much, knowing that at some point he had been charged with grand larceny but convicted of petty larceny, played into that and into why max the fine? Why add the fine and the jail sentence?
Let me go back for a minute to Judge Hoff's question about the 2007 amendment. Your contention is that 2007 amendment was merely to allow the sentence to be introduced. Is that right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, and it was limited to that. How about the Brooks case where the court held that an underlying indictment for a prior conviction is admissible during the sentencing phase as part of the record of conviction?
Yes, Your Honor, and I think Brooks is distinguishable because in that case, the issue is that the sentencing order or the final order in the case said he is convicted and here is the sentence. He's convicted of what was charged in the indictment. They never specified a code. They never summarized the name of the offense. So any subsequent reviewing party would have no idea what that conviction was. It could have been a DUI. It could have been murder. They had no idea. The only way to complete the record, the history of the conviction, was to allow the introduction of the indictment. It was not an indictment where he was indicted for one charge, convicted of a different charge. It was referenced in the final order that he's convicted as charged in the indictment, and that was the phrasing for the type of conviction.
I think Judge O'Brien and I are thinking along the same lines because I was going to follow up on Judge Huss' question as well. The amendment, as Judge Huff referred to it, pointed out that the change is to criminal now includes the words criminal history, but it goes on to say, including prior convictions and punishments imposed by certified, attested, and exemplified copies of the final order. So you suggest that we apparently read that to effectively say shall present the defendant's prior criminal history limited to prior convictions and punishments, where the General Assembly used the word including. So it seems to me the word including isn't a limiting word, it's an expansive word. And
explanatory.
Yeah, so, I mean, you know, and it seems to me that criminal history arguably includes the original charge and along with whatever disposition was made of that charge, whether it was guilty of a lesser included offense or an amended indictment or something of that nature. So, you know, why can the General Assembly simply authorize exactly what occurred here in that state? Why is it, is there constitutional prejudice here somehow that we're not seeing or what?
I also wanted to circle back to Judge Huff's question as well. I think the thing we need to keep straight is that where the statute, where 295.1 is allowing the admission of the criminal history or the criminal record of conviction, either before or after, it still is not changing the rules about what is admissible. And when pieces of evidence become more prejudicial than they are probative, then they are not admissible.
Well, the purpose for not admitting convictions during a criminal history information, ordinarily, there are exceptions, but ordinarily during the guilt or innocence phase, is we don't want a jury to convict someone of a crime because they committed another crime. We want them to convict them because of what they did in this particular occasion. Now, it seems to me that's not the risk when you're dealing with sentencing. We're past that. And the General Assembly has made an affirmative decision that juries should be acquainted with the criminal history before they recommend a sentence to the trial court. Given that, it seems to me that risk is not that would be there at the guilt or innocence level is not there at the sentencing level, because what's wrong with the jury knowing what a judge would know after a pre-sentence report, in effect?
And, Your Honor, I would argue that in the Byrd case, it details some of the issues that can be involved when inadmissible evidence is admitted, at the, even at the sentencing phase, where it's been bifurcated, because the jury is still deciding. They are in voir dire, we're allowed to voir dire about whether they're biased in the issuing of a sentence. Because even even with the trial being bifurcated, there's still the ability for the defendant to be prejudiced, to have inadmissible evidence admitted. And I'll point the court as well to the idea that the amendment to the code by the General Assembly, I would argue, does not change the law about probation violations not being convictions that jurors should be presented, that null prost or dismissed charges do not now come in and should be presented to the jury at this bifurcated sentencing portion. That's why I think that history, it really, in context of what the General Assembly was addressing and the case law that had occurred just before, had to do with, can we tell them the sentences that were given on these convictions? And that's where I think the General Assembly was clarifying and trying to amend the. I would not agree that the General Assembly was opening it up that now any charge that someone has been charged with, even if it was null pros, dismissed, they were found not guilty, that any of those now becomes admissible over a defendant's objection. I'd also point the court to the language located in, it's actually in the Brooks case that Your Honor mentioned. The court, it's in the beginning of the opinion, but the court says, accordingly, should a sentencing hearing occur on remand, the trial court may, in the exercise of its sound discretion, admit so much of the indictment for a prior conviction as may be material and relevant. And so this goes as well to the court's question about the sentencing order and how the indictment came in. So the court is referencing that items, even though the entirety of the order may seem relevant and admissible, it can be amended, it can be redacted. The Byrd case says that by admitting the unredacted order, the trial court abused its discretion. And so there is room in the prior case law for a final order to be redacted or amended appropriately to prevent the jurors from being given information that is either going to be confusing or is going to lead them to speculate. For instance, in this case, they may speculate that Mr. Robinson already received a large break in his prior history, that this was simply the kindness of the Commonwealth and the court deciding, we'll let you have a misdemeanor on this one, and that's why he should have to pay a higher fine. That's why he should be sentenced for the whole 12 months. And so that is why we'd ask Your Honor to remand this to the circuit, to the trial court, for a new sentencing hearing.
All right. Thank you. Mr. Chandeville?
May it please the court. Good morning. Chris Chandeville for the Commonwealth. In order to rule in Mr. Robinson's favor in this appeal, this court would have to rewrite Code Section 19.2295.1 by adding words that the General Assembly did not include and by changing words that the General Assembly explicitly chose. This court should reject that invitation and affirm the judgment below based on a plain reading of the statute as it exists and has existed since 2007. In 2007, when the General Assembly made the changes to 19.2295.1, there were really three changes that were made. The first is changing the words prior criminal conviction to prior criminal history. The second is to insert the phrase including prior convictions in the punishments imposed. And the third change was to change the phrase record of conviction to final order. All three of those changes support the conclusion that the trial court correctly decided in this case that it was not required to redact a final order that was a record of a prior conviction and sentence.
So what limits, if any, does the Commonwealth see given that those changes? Obviously, we by definition have to have final orders as opposed to interlocutory orders, but beyond that, is there any limitation of what occurred in a criminal case that would be barred from introduction at a sentencing hearing?
As the law is currently stated, no, Your Honor, I don't think there would be. As long as it is a final order that is a part of that criminal history, so it includes a conviction and sentence, then that is sufficient, and no redacting would need to be done. Prior to that change, the ambiguous language in the statute, of course, was that phrase "record of conviction," and that had led to a good amount of litigation in this court and the Supreme Court of Virginia as to what exactly that ambiguous phrase "record of conviction" means. And so, in 2007, the General Assembly took out that phrase entirely and inserted in its place the phrase "final order." What the General Assembly was doing was removing what was an ambiguity and making it very plain and very clear the way in which you prove criminal history. And the way in which you do it is, quote, by, certified, attested to, copies of that final order. So as long as that is the manner in which the Commonwealth is introducing that evidence, as long as it is a final order, then there is no need to do any sort of redacting of any additional information out of that final order. If the General Assembly changes its mind and decides down the road that, you know, it turns out that some of these final orders have additional information that we don't want to go to the jury, or if prosecutors started including additional information in their final orders or trial courts did.
I think your opponent mentioned probation violations. Now, I'm not sure they're necessarily criminal. I think they're technically civil. They require only a preponderance of the evidence to violate. I know we have jurisdiction over them because the Supreme Court says we do, but I think originally we said we didn't because they were civil in nature. But hypothetically, would that be a criminal order revoking someone's probation? Would that be a criminal sentencing order as far as the Commonwealth is concerned?
That type of situation may not qualify under the statute. The question in a case like that would be, what does prior criminal history mean? And so given that that's a civil proceeding, not a criminal proceeding, it would be fair for a court to conclude that perhaps that's not part of the prior criminal history. Here, there's really no debate that this final order does include Mr. Robertson's prior criminal history. The only question is whether that can be proven by a final order that's not redacted or whether there needs to be some redacting. And since 2007 and that change, a final order is sufficient. There is no need to redact. The response in the reply brief and here today is that, well, the only thing that General Assembly was trying to change was try to broaden the statute so it would also include sentences and not just be limited to convictions. Of course, what this court is to look at in determining what the statute means is the plain meaning of the words the legislature chose, not just the most recent decision by this court, the Supreme Court of Virginia, before that change was made. And if the General Assembly had intended to amend the statute only to allow the sentences to also be included, they could have easily done that. They could have changed the phrase prior criminal convictions to prior criminal convictions and sentences, and they could have changed the phrase copies of the revocation or the record of conviction to copies of the record of conviction and sentence. Instead, what they did is they chose much more broad language. They chose the phrase prior criminal history, and they also chose the phrase the final order. Those certainly encompass the sentence, but the plain reading of those phrases is that they encompass much more. And so it's certainly, under the plain reading of statute, includes what was included here, which was just the initial charge, which ultimately resulted in the conviction, the prior conviction in this case. So for those reasons, we do think under plain reading the statute, this court should affirm on the merits. We think also that if the court wanted to affirm on harmless error grounds, the court could do that also without reaching the merits. It's clear based on this court's prior case law that any error that could have occurred here, even assuming we were under the old version of the statute, not the current version of the statute, any error would have been harmless. In the Byrd case, the defendant faced a same possible sentencing range of 1 to 10 years. In that case, he was given 5 years, and this court ultimately concluded that any error was harmless. In this case, the range was the same, but he only got 1 year. And so
you want to respond to the prejudice argument here? I mean, that doesn't seem like, other than the fine, I guess, the defendant in this case received the sentence, at least within the range requested by his own counsel.
Correct, Your Honor. He received exactly what his counsel has suggested was appropriate. The fact that there was also an additional $2,500 fine that was given. In the Byrd case, the range was 1 to 10 years, and the defendant got 5 years, and this court held that there was no prejudice, any error was harmless. In this case, the range was the same, 1 to 10 years, and the defendant got 12 months incarceration. plus a $2,500 fine. I think every criminal defendant in the Commonwealth of Virginia would tell you that a $2,500 fine is better than an extra four-year sentence incarceration.
But apparently you can't pay it in the first place.
So. Correct, Your Honor. Correct, Your Honor. So for that reason, based on this court's case law, it's clear that any error was harmless. I'll also add that the only true objection and request for redaction below was the request to remove the phrase felony of grand larceny. The conviction order also stated at the top of that order that the indictment was for grand larceny, and the judge asked defense counsel to clarify, are you asking us to remove those words too? And she said no, only the four words, felony of grand larceny, which is contained down in the body of the prior conviction order. So for that reason, really only the only part of that conviction order that was objected to that wasn't cumulative of other language in the order was the word felony. And, of course, the jury knew that he'd been convicted of a prior felony for possession of cocaine, knew that he'd just been convicted of this felony. For that additional reason, that there was no prejudice here, so any error would have had to have been harmless. So for all of these reasons, unless the court has any further questions, we'll ask the court to affirm.
Hearing none, we thank you. Ms. Robinson.
Thank you.
Thank you. I just want to address a few points that have been raised regarding the General Assembly's amendments to the statute. I think to construe those amendments in the way that the Commonwealth is asking the court to would end up overturning quite a bit of case law that I think would essentially then erupt here as well, because it would go in direct contradiction with the law, with the rules of evidence about what is admissible.
Can't the General Assembly change the rules of evidence but the stroke of
they
the
statute? They can, but I would argue that that's not what they did in amending 192.295.1. They did not change, they did not mention admissibility, or they did not, for instance, indicate unredacted final orders. Or I think essentially what they were doing was addressing I do think that they were addressing the sentencing issue, and also perhaps the issue that was raised in Folsom, where it was challenged that the record couldn't come in because it wasn't technically a final order. It was kind of the court's printout, I believe, of a conviction, but it still showed a conviction. And so I think the General Assembly is trying to address, you know, in fairness, a conviction is a conviction, and that should come in. But I think that it is stretching way too far to say that the General Assembly was now opening the door to null pros charges, to, in this case, amended charges. Also, to circle back to the issue of prejudice, I'll point to the court as well. The Byrd case was, is one that this can be compared to. In that case, it was a possession with intent to distribute marijuana. The issue was that there were three null pros charges that had been mentioned introduced at the sentencing. The court ruled that that was an abuse of discretion by admitting those, and then in deciding whether or not it was it was so prejudicial that it wasn't harmless. Thank you. That it was not harmless error. They arrived at the issue that there were seven other theft convictions, and that those three null pros were also theft convictions. That is entirely different from Mr. Robinson's case, and the assumption that jurors just lumped it all in and probably weren't persuaded by it. I would argue that even in Byrd, it was a bit of a heavy assumption on the part of the court, but our case today is distinguishable from Byrd, and we would have to make an entirely larger speculation to arrive at the conclusion that it was harmless, and it's the Commonwealth's burden to show that it was harmless error, and they have not been able to do that today. Right. We're asking this court to remand for a new sentencing hearing.
Thank you very much. We'll step down and greet counsel and then take up the case of Lally versus the Commonwealth.